Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's Supreme Court arguments over striking down Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act that requires nine states with a history of discrimination to seek prior approval from the Justice Department to change their election laws. Elizabeth Wydra, Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Centre, who frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation, joins us. We'll discuss early indications that Scalia and other conservatives on the court are itching to turn back the clock. Then we will speak with the veteran crime reporter with the Boston Globe, Shelley Murphy, the author of the new book, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. We'll discuss little-known aspects of the case, such as Bulger's participation in the CIA's MK-Ultra LSD experiments, the extent of corruption and criminal complicity in the FBI that enabled C4 explosives to be shipped to the IRA, and the most wanted fugitive's final capture in Santa Monica, based on a tip from a friend of mine. Then finally, we'll go to London and get a perspective on how America's impending self-inflicted economic wound is seen from abroad and how the Europeans are reacting to the re-emergence of Berlusconi and the political paralysis he brings to the Eurozone's third largest economy that threatens to unravel modest gains made so far in stabilizing the euro. Economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones joins us to discuss the devastating effects austerity have had on Europe, yet in spite of the warnings, the world's largest economy is poised to drink the same poison. Joining us now is Elizabeth Wydra, who's the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank, law firm, and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeal. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Wydra.
Thank you, Ian. It's great to be with you and your listeners.
And your organization, the Constitutional Accountability Center, filed an amicus brief in this case, Shelby versus Holder, in defense of Section 5. So you clearly have a dog in this fight, if you will.
Yes.
I'm sorry for the Bill Clinton quote there. It doesn't look good, does it? I mean, my impressions, particularly some of the more hostile questioning that came from Justice Scalia, where he said that he derided the legislation as a perpetuation of racial entitlement.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly left the courthouse feeling more optimistic than I did this morning. But, you know, those of us who support the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act, and I should mention that while I work for a left-leaning organization, support for the Voting Rights Act in this case has been across the ideological spectrum. You have the Attorney General for Presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush leading a brief in support of the act. So, you know, it's a reflection of the fact that, as we'll talk about in a moment, there is widespread support for the Voting Rights Act, and in fact, that's why Congress overwhelmingly, bipartisanly, I mean, can we even imagine that, you know, happening today, reauthorized this preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act. But you're right, Justice Scalia went on a rather, honestly, a bizarre and frankly offensive rant about how the reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act, one of the most iconic civil rights laws ever passed by Congress, was, in his words, a perpetuation of racial entitlement. And, you know, I think that the right to vote free from discrimination is an American entitlement, something that we all should be able to expect. And so I thought that that just was really, frankly, shocking.
So did anybody point out to Justice Scalia, not that he had the opportunity to get in arguments with the justices, but just the fact that in the last election, the Section 5 was used I think in both in the Texas case and in a South Carolina case by the Justice Department to strike down changes to election laws that would have discriminated against students, women, and Latinos largely.
Yeah, you know, I was actually surprised that what happened in the 2012 election didn't come up during argument today. Certainly what came up was the record that Congress amassed in 2006 when it reauthorized the act, more than 15,000 pages of incidents of state-sponsored racial discrimination in the areas covered by the preclearance provision. But you're absolutely right that the 2012 election proved that the Voting Rights Act is still our nation's first and best defense against efforts to disenfranchise voters.
Well, I don't know whether there's any point in beating up on poor Mr. Varelli, but it seems like all of these cases that we've had recently, where there's been a lot at stake, a lot of people have been disappointed in him. The Chief Justice sort of treated him like a schoolchild, didn't he? When he asked him for examples, and he didn't know them. He didn't know which had the most African American participation, which state, and which had the least.
Well, I think that the reason he didn't know them is because it honestly doesn't matter.
Sure. Well, it was a bit of a red herring. You're right.
Yeah. And I thought Solicitor General Verrilli did a fantastic job. You know, he was actually the one who was standing up at the podium when Justice Scalia went off on his rant and, you know, very calmly, you know, responded, well, there's a lot to say to that, Justice Scalia, which is an understatement. But, you know, what he was pointing out, and he repeatedly emphasized this, and this gets to Chief Justice Roberts' question, is that the Constitution expressly grants Congress the power to decide which voting rights laws are going to be most effective in enforcing the constitutional guarantee of the right to vote free from racial discrimination. So maybe Chief Justice Roberts or Justice Anthony Kennedy would, if they were in Congress, come up with a different coverage formula or different preclearance provision. But the constitutional point that the Supreme Court should be limiting itself to is whether or not Congress showed that there was enough of a record that this was a reasonable, appropriate way to deal with what I think everyone would admit is a continuing problem. And it's not the Supreme Court's job to second guess Congress's decision, particularly given this massive record that they amass showing that racial discrimination continues to be a particular problem in those areas covered by preclearance, which are primarily in the South. And, you know, Shelby County, Alabama, which is the county that's bringing this challenge in the Supreme Court, is a perfect example. They continue to have problems with discriminatory voting practices. And that was brought up today repeatedly by Justices Sotomayor and Kagan and Ginsburg.
And Justice Kagan brought up the point that 98 senators voted in favor of renewing the legislation, none voted against it, and yet Justice Anthony Scalia dismissed that.
Yes, you know, I really don't get that, you know, but if he wants to start criticizing unanimous Senate approvals, I would point out that his nomination for the Supreme Court was approved unanimously in the Senate. So, you know, I don't think he's one to throw stones. But more importantly, I just don't get that. You know, I mean, I think it's an example of Congress actually doing the right thing. And, you know,
particularly in contrast to what's happening now with all this gridlock. I mean, whenever the Senate agrees on anything, it's pretty amazing nowadays, you know.
Exactly. I mean, this is an iconic civil rights law that was reauthorized in 2006 by wide bipartisan majorities and signed into law by President George W. Bush. You know, that's something that I think all Americans would get behind, and I think that they will be very disappointed if the Supreme Court strikes down this iconic and still vital statute.
Again, I'm speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who is the Chief Counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution supports progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. And we're talking about today's Supreme Court arguments about whether or not to strike down Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And what was that? And of course, if you go by the normal formula, excuse me, of who are the conservatives are and who the swing vote is, Justice Kennedy. If the conservatives are going to overturn this, and certainly it's pretty clear that Scalia is itching to do so, what Justice Kennedy had to say today wasn't encouraging. And he also seemed to suggest that I think it's Section 2 was sufficient. You don't need Section 5. Could you explain what he was getting at?
Yeah, so the way that the Voting Rights Act works is sort of a sword and a shield. What we've been talking about before, the preclearance provision, is really a shield against discriminatory voting practices. It weeds out most of these discriminatory practices just by the fact that state and local governments will have to get them precleared. So knowing that they're going to be checked up upon, they don't actually even try to go through these discriminatory practices in the first place. So there's a strong deterrent effect. And Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act is sort of the sword of the act. It's a more affirmative provision that allows individuals who have been discriminated against in voting or the federal government to pursue litigation against the offending entities. The problem is that it's much more difficult to bring this affirmative litigation. It requires, obviously, the practice to already have been enacted. Even if you try to get, you know, something, even if you try to get the court to stop it from going into effect, you know, you don't have the same deterrent effect necessarily that you have from the preclearance provision. And again, you know, I thought that Justice Kennedy asked some interesting questions about, you know, well, how could that work? And, you know, but it's not the court's job to try to figure that out. Their job is not to try to come up with a better Voting Rights Act. Their job is to consider whether what Congress did is appropriate. That's what the Constitution says, appropriate legislation, whether Congress passed appropriate legislation to enforce the 15th Amendment's guarantee of the right to vote free from discrimination. And I think that a lot of the second guessing that was going on in the from the conservative justices this morning really just has no place in this constitutional dispute.
So do you think that they'll roll back a little when in private on this, given that they had an opportunity to strike it down, did they not, in what was it, 2006? 2009, the Texas,
right.
Northwest Austin municipality versus Holder.
Exactly. And, you know, that's sort of what defenders of the Voting Rights Act like me, you know, hold on to, is that, you know, the conservative justices had the opportunity to strike the act down in that case. And none of them, except for Justice Thomas, was willing to go all the way there. And so, you know, I hope, being an optimistic person, that some of the conservative justices will again think twice before striking down this, what has proven to be sort of the engine of progress in voting equality over, you know, the past several decades. But it's it is certainly very troubling, and you know, the court has dodged the issue once. Are they going to do it again? I don't know.
Well, if they do, though, wouldn't it constitute a classic definition of a judicial activism? Because it would be a vote essentially based upon ideology and this idea that that the efforts to undo discrimination are worse than discrimination itself. That has been going on here forever, and it's because it's affected the University of California and its entrance. And these people make these arguments, and there's no evidence at all. And then when they get their way and they undo these laws like they did with the University of California entrance system, now we have an enormous you know, minority of African Americans and Latinos in the UC system. The numbers have gone down precipitously. So the evidence is clear in retrospect, but You know, this is not based on data. It's based upon a kind of peculiar kind of atavistic kind of ideology.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, if you look at the data, certainly I think that there's support for Congress's decision that, well, yes, there are some problems with voting suppression across the country, and Section 2 of the Act, which we talked about, covers the entire country. The concentration of voting discrimination in the South is such that it's appropriate to put this, you know, stronger medicine of the preclearance provision for those covered jurisdictions only. And when you talk about judicial activism, you know, there are parts of the Constitution where the courts are supposed to be sort of vigorous defenders of these provisions. But when it comes to the 15th Amendment's right to vote free from racial discrimination, the drafters of that amendment specifically intended to give Congress and not the courts responsibility for protecting against voting discrimination. And, you know, when you think about the fact that the 15th Amendment was passed in the wake of the Civil War, it's unsurprising that they would be reluctant to give the courts power over this, given that just a few years earlier, the Supreme Court had issued the infamous Dred Scott ruling, which said that an African-American didn't have any rights that white men had to respect. So, you know, the framers of the 15th Amendment specifically wanted the Supreme Court to defer to Congress. And so this judicial restraint that Chief Justice Roberts has in particular professed to follow is written into the Constitution when it comes to protecting the right to vote.
Well, just in closing, Elizabeth Wydra, the representative for Shelby County that's bringing this suit, Bert Rein, he was pretty much slapped down by Justice Sotomayor, who pointed out, because he said, oh, it's all over, you know, we're different now, the past is the past, etc., and we've moved on. She said that in the period we're talking about, there were 240 discriminating voting laws that were blocked by Section 5 objections in your county, for God's sake. I mean, did that shut him up or at least pull him over?
Well, no, unfortunately. You know, that was how the argument opened this morning. Justices Sotomayor in particular, but also Kagan, they really did an excellent job of pointing out that, you know, look, you, Shelby County, are a perfect example of why we still need the Voting Rights Act, because your county has engaged in some of, you know, some very blatant voting discrimination. And so, you know, I thought that Sotomayor in particular made a very strong case for the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. And in fact, she, at the end of the argument this morning, you know, was the one who really pushed back against Justice Scalia's racial entitlement theory of the Voting Rights Act in a way that was very simple but eloquent, pointing out that, you know, the problem that the Voting Rights Act seeks to remedy is discrimination in voting. And that is something that is a constitutional right and an American value, and not some sort of ridiculous, you know, goodie given out to a certain constituency.
Well, it sure is clear to me who are the justices that represent the future and who are the justices that represent the past. And let's hope the future prevails. I thank you for joining us, Elizabeth Wydra.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Elizabeth Wydra, who's the chief counsel of the Constitutional Accountability Center, a think tank law firm and an action center dedicated to showing how the text and history of the Constitution support progressive outcomes. She frequently participates in Supreme Court litigation and has argued several important cases in the federal courts of appeals. And she was in the Supreme Court today since she had filed an amicus brief in the Shelby versus Holder case in defense of Section 5 of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about America's most wanted gangster. Here comes the judge.
Tell me about it in Boston as a teen back in 1943. He and his brothers were known to police in Southie for stealing cars and petty larceny. The Air Force took him on in 48. He went absent without leave. Volunteered as a government test monkey, cut short his stint in penitentiary. You can see what you want.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Shelley Murphy, who is the winner of the George Polk Award. She has covered organized crime since 1985, beginning at the Boston Herald and moving to the Boston Globe in 1993. She is the co-author with Kevin Cullen of the new book Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shelley Murphy.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
And as it happens, Shelley, just by pure circumstance, I have to be a friend of the person who got the reward from the FBI for fingering, I guess is the word in crime parlance, Whitey Bulger here in sunny Santa Monica.
Well, I would hope you would convey to her that she is a hero to the people in Boston. You know, there are many family members of some of Whitey's alleged victims who thought the day would never come that he would be arrested. I mean, they waited many years, and the fear was that he would ride off into the sunset. So you should let your friend know that she is viewed as a hero here in Boston.
Well, she's actually, since the story broke, of course, she's been very nervous about retribution from Whitey Bulger. He's a bad dude, right?
He is a bad dude, and I can certainly understand her concern. One thing I would say to her, though, is that after he fled, you know, many of his former associates came forward and cooperated with the government after learning that he was a longtime FBI informant, and they implicated him in numerous murders. They led police to secret graves where victims were buried decades ago and you know, helped recover those remains. And, you know, many of those people who cooperated are here walking around the city of Boston, and there has been no retribution. Also, his girlfriend, his longtime girlfriend, not the one who, you know, was with him on the run when he was captured, but another one cooperated against him and gave up his, you know, one of his aliases. And she, you know, she lived here in Boston. She died last year of lung cancer. But there are a lot of people who have cooperated against him. And so, you know, and they are, I don't think Whitey Bulger has very many friends left out there. And certainly there is no gang, nothing left of the gang that he once ran.
So, Shelley Murphy, just for the benefit of the audience, could you give us a brief sketch about why this Whitey Bulger was America's most wanted gangster, what he did, and how he escaped justice? Just, you know, a brief sketch so people can catch up to our conversation.
Well, I mean, it goes back to, you know, the early days in Boston. Back in the 1970s, 1980s, the FBI's number one priority nationwide was targeting the mafia. And in Boston, you know, there was also a very powerful Irish mob, and Whitey was the head of that. And Whitey very ingeniously positioned himself so that he was an FBI informant against the mafia. By providing information against his rivals, it allowed them to be prosecuted and sent off to prison, and he sort of swept in and picked up, you know, more and more control of the city's, you know, rackets. He was shaking down drug dealers, you know, getting a tribute from drugs that ran throughout the neighborhood where he grew up, shaking down legitimate business people, bookmakers, and he became very powerful here. He also was tipped shortly before his arrest by a corrupt FBI agent that he was about to be indicted, which allowed him to flee. Now, once he fled, the story, you know, some of his former, you know, associates were captured, and the story began to unfold here of this corrupt relationship with the FBI. He used to have dinner with FBI agents, trade Christmas gifts. There are some that have admitted to taking payoffs from him. And you know, over this time, he was accused of killing people, that people here would go to the FBI with information, you know, about Whitey. Somebody would tip him off. That person would be killed. So when it was revealed that he was an FBI informant, it was a huge embarrassment to the FBI in Boston. And that is why it was so important to them to name him to the 10 most wanted list. And as you know, the 16 years he managed to elude capture until your friend, the only person to ever give an accurate tip of where he was and actually lead to his capture there in Santa Monica.
Again, I'm speaking with Shelley Murphy, who is the author of the brand new book, or the co-author of the brand new book with Kevin Cullen, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. She is the winner of the George Polk Award and has covered organized crime since 1985, beginning at the Boston Herald and moving to the Boston Globe in 1993. And this book is an extraordinary read. And normally, Shelley, I cover national security affairs, and there is, of course, a fascinating component in this story that people don't know about, that Whitey Bulger was involved in those early CIA MKUltra program on LSD experiments, and to some extent, didn't he milk his relationship with the CIA to avoid scrutiny for a long time? In other words, he basically, whatever happened happened to him mentally during that period of time, which is certainly worth talking about, he was able to parlay that into a certain amount of protection, was he not, from law enforcement?
Well, I don't know if he parlayed that into protection, but he certainly has. He certainly did when he was in the Atlanta Federal Prison in the late 50s serving time for bank robbery. He was a young man in his 20s then. He volunteered, as you said, to be injected with LSD, and he was led to believe that this experiment was to find a cure for schizophrenia, when in fact it was secretly sponsored by the CIA, and it was at a time when I don't think people really understood the effects of LSD. Now, Whitey Bulger was a man who prided himself on being physically fit. He did not do drugs. He did not drink. He was very, very active, you know. And so when he participated in these experiments, they made him absolutely crazy. I mean, according to people who witnessed, you know, how he reacted, he was a man deranged. And he complained for years that those experiments continued to haunt his sleep, that he would have nightmares and wake up screaming and yelling. As you know, there have always been rumors since, you know, he was able to avoid capture for so long about whether or not, you know, he did have some authority, somebody protecting him out there beyond the FBI agents. But there's been no evidence of that to date presented in court. But he also was involved in a plan to ship guns to the Irish Republican Army back in the 80s, a huge shipment of weapons that left from Boston to Ireland, which were seized off the coast of Ireland. And that triggered all sorts of rumors about, you know, whether he was being protected by other agencies. And now, you know, his defense in court, which when he goes to trial in June, he claims that he had immunity, that a prosecutor who died some years ago from the Justice Department promised him immunity for all crimes, including murder.
Well, of course, I think a lot of our listeners, Shelley Murphy, might sort of feel that the Martin Scorsese 2006 movie Departed, where Jack Nicholson played a Whitey Bulger character, is the kind of official story. And of course, the truth of the matter is, your book, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice, really is an awful lot more rich than even the movie was. And it was a pretty good movie from my recollection.
It was a great movie. Yes, it was.
But not really the movie.
No, I think the Jack Nicholson character was, you know, loosely based on Whitey, and much of the movie was shot in and around Boston, the very streets where Whitey used to hold court. But the truth is that, you know, that Jack Nicholson character, he was very sort of sloppy. There's a scene where he comes out and his hands are covered in blood. And Whitey's associates say that he was much more meticulous, calculating than that, that he was very careful, that, and it's quite chilling that he would kill people and then go upstairs and take a nap, that he seemed to get some sort of release after he killed people. We found there are lots of dimensions to him, though, that he was a very charismatic guy who was able to, you know, if he liked you, then he would make you like him. If he didn't like you, then clearly you had a problem. But he's someone who would be out conducting criminal business on the streets of Boston and then go home to a girlfriend who had four young children. He helped raise them, and he insisted on family sit-down dinners every night. The telephone couldn't ring. He lectured the children on, you know, doing well, studying hard, staying away from negative influences, and then he would go off and do his thing. He really compartmentalized his life.
Well, take us back, Shirley Murphy, to the extraordinary chapter where he was a political activist, if you will, of the worst kind, where he firebombed against the integration of schools in the 1970s, the desegregation of Boston's public school, including firebombing John F. Kennedy's birthplace.
Yeah, you know, South Boston, and there have been, you know, there back during the 1970s when Boston schools were desegregated, there was a lot of bitterness in Whitey's hometown of South Boston. They did not like the fact that children in their neighborhood were being bused across town to other neighborhoods in order to desegregate the schools. And really, you know, there was this feeling in Southie that who is this federal judge that would foist this on us in order to desegregate the schools, send our children out of the neighborhoods to schools that the court found were actually inferior. They felt that they were being used as guinea pigs in this experiment. Even those who believe that the cause was a noble one to try to desegregate schools, the idea that their students were being, you know, bused out of the neighborhood and then black students were bused in caused a lot of protest. Whitey carried this to a whole different extreme. I mean, he worked behind the scenes. From what we've been told from his associates is that he did some very symbolic acts. As you said, he firebombed the birthplace of President John F. Kennedy, which is in Brookline, Massachusetts, neighboring Boston. And he threw a Molotov cocktail through the window of the home, which was a National Historic Site and still is. And he was very upset that that John F. Kennedy's brother Ted was an outspoken advocate of desegregation, and so he spray painted on the sidewalk outside the home "Bus Teddy," which was a reference to Ted Kennedy. He also firebombed a school, which was in the neighborhood of where the federal judge lived, in a suburb of Boston, and firebombed a school. He knew there was too much security around the judge's house, so he firebombed the school and then called and said, if our children will be bused, so will yours.
Well, it's extraordinary the amount of mayhem that he wrought. I mean, how many people did he murder?
He's charged with killing 19 people, including two women, and eight of those murders happened while he was an FBI informant.
And that's really the rub. We talked earlier about possible him getting a free pass from having cooperated with the CIA on the MK-Ultra LSD experiments. There may be some doubts about that, but there's no doubts about his role in the shipment of C4 explosives. That's the plastic explosive, one of the hardest things to get your hands on. And a friendly FBI agent was involved in Whitey's ability to get hold of the C4, which is shipped to the Irish Republican Army.
Yeah, I mean, this is that we have revealed that for the first time in our book, that one of Bulge's closest associates, a man named Steve Flemmy, who was also a longtime FBI informant, told authorities after he began cooperating some years ago about this claim that this FBI agent did, in fact, give them C4, and they did send it over in a van to the IRA, and, you know, it may have been used over there to, I mean, it's unclear whether anybody died as a result of the C4 explosives being shipped over there. Now, the FBI agent, you know, I spoke with him. He absolutely denies that ever happened. He said he did not have access to the C4. He did not give it to them. But what I found the most amazing thing is that he said he was never, you know, after Bulge's associate told investigators about this, he says he was never questioned about it by the FBI or anybody else.
Well, obviously, the FBI pursued him with a great and put him up on their most wanted list for so long and put out that substantial reward for him, I think, in many ways to overcome the embarrassment of their earlier dealings with him. Isn't that without...
Oh, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. When he first fled in 1995, he actually was warned by his former FBI handler that he was about to be indicted, and he took off. And initially, there was very little effort sincere effort, I believe, to find him. I mean, they put the organized crime squad in Boston, the FBI's organized crime squad, was the unit tasked to find him. This is the same unit that he was an informant for. He was actually there was a story that he saved the life of an undercover FBI agent by warning that, that the people he was dealing with knew he was an agent. So the agent whose life he saved, his brother was the one in charge of the manhunt in the beginning. And so, in the beginning, the FBI kept the search to itself, and it was only when, it came out in federal court where a judge, ordered the government to come clean, tell us if he was an informant, and the FBI and the Justice Department confirmed, yes, he was an FBI informant. And, because of the charges against him and his reputation in Boston, it really put the pressure on the FBI to find him. And it's at that point that a couple of years after he fled that they called in other agencies and created a task force to look for him. But I think most of the leads, were really early on. And by the time this task force was created, Whitey had pretty much severed ties with people back in Boston.
But Shelley Murphy, what explains the actions of the Justice Department in their disgraceful legal battles against the victims of Whitey Bulger, the families, for the pain and suffering money that they were granted by the courts? What explains that kind of peculiar vindictiveness?
Well, that is a terrific question, because there's a lot of outrage here about the way the government has handled the wrongful death suits filed by the victims' families. The government has really talked out of both sides of their mouth, because in the criminal cases, they have said, these FBI agents are corrupt, they leaked information that got, people killed. And then in the civil cases, the Justice Department in Washington has come in and said, well, you can't even believe what those witnesses are saying in the criminal cases. And the judges rejected that. And the judges found that, no, that the district court level found, no, there's evidence of FBI liability here. There's evidence that it was not a case of just a couple of corrupt agents, that people at very high levels in the FBI and the Justice Department not only knew that Whitey was a suspect in some murders, but actually interfered with efforts by other agencies to bring him to justice in those cases. And the reason many of the wrongful death suits, most of the wrongful death suits, never even made it to trial, because there's a rule, you can only sue the federal government within so many years, within 2 years of knowing that you have, been the victim of the government in a wrongful death. You have to bring the suit within 2 years of when you knew the FBI, was at fault, or a reasonable person should have known. And so what the appeals court here in Boston has said in many of these cases is, you should have known earlier that the FBI was involved. You should have known earlier that they were liable, and you just waited too long to bring your suit.
So tell us about the extraordinary relationship with the brother. It's sort of almost a Greek tragedy.
It is, and his brother, Billy Bulger, his younger brother, he was one of the most powerful politicians in Massachusetts. He was the longtime president of the Massachusetts State Senate. And the two brothers, they were, there were six children in that family. They grew up poor, really, in the first housing project in Boston. And Billy, was very studious. He went to law school, became a lawyer, became a state senator. Whitey went off on a different path, but even when there was always this loyalty in that neighborhood, loyalty is the number one thing. I mean, and Billy was always loyal to Whitey. His feeling was always, this is my brother. I don't think he really believed he did all these things he was accused of, and he felt, he's my brother, I will not condemn him. And when Whitey first went to prison for bank robbery in the late 50s, Billy, then just a law student, was his biggest advocate, writing to prison officials saying, look, I really care for my brother. I believe he'll go straight. He was lobbying to have his brother transferred closer to home, to have him paroled early. And meanwhile, Whitey is getting in trouble in prison and involved in an escape attempt and is then transferred to Alcatraz and spent some time there. But Billy always believed and was his brother's biggest supporter. And, you know, the FBI agent who recruited Whitey as an informant had actually been mentored by Billy Bulger.
I thank you so much for joining us here, Shelley.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Shelley Murphy, who is the co-author with Kevin Cullen of the brand new book, Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. Shelley is the winner of the George Polk Award and covered organized crime since 1985, beginning at the Boston Herald and moving to the Boston Globe in 1993. We're going to take a brief station break and be back and go to London to get a perspective on America's impending self-inflicted economic wound. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from London is economist Stephanie Griffiths-Jones, who is currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University. She is the author of the new book, Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephanie Griffiths-Jones.
Hey, great to be with you again.
And, well, it's not the best circumstances, though, because it's one thing when economies crash for various reasons and, you know, economics has not been the most exact science, shall we say. But when things happen on the scale of what just happened in Italy and what's about to happen here in the United States in the next couple of days, where they seem to be completely self-inflicted financial wounds, that I find incomprehensible.
I think you're completely right. I mean, particularly in the U.S., I think the fact that the Republican Party doesn't want to reach agreement on a very reasonable proposal from the president is a totally self-inflicted wound, which could cause massive damage to the U.S. economy and indeed to the world economy. At the same time, in Europe, we have had, first of all, you know, very bad policies, these austerity policies that people like Joe Stiglitz and Paul Krugman have so rightly said are very negative. They're bad arithmetic, they ignore the lessons of history, and they're bad economics. And unfortunately, the reality has shown what has been said to be correct, and people are reacting, the electorate is reacting against those austerity policies, rightly, but unfortunately it's choosing populist channels to do that. I mean, how can one explain that so many people in Italy voted for Berlusconi, who is not a serious politician, who has done so much damage to Italy? And even this movement by Pepe Grillo, which is interesting as a protest vote, I don't think has a clear alternative. And it's very unfortunate, I think, that the center-left, led by Bersani, didn't do better because it could have provided a kind of constructive alternative to austerity, a more growth-oriented alternative.
What do you make of the president's meeting on Friday with congressional leaders? I mean, that's the day that the sequester comes into play. So it's sort of a day short, but are they going to come up with anything, do you think?
Well, I very much hope so, that the rationality will prevail, because I think, you know, it would be amazing if they didn't take action. I mean, although I think the damage wouldn't be so great in the very short term, but it would really set the American economy in a very slippery slope. As to Europe, I think that there are alternatives. I mean, we've been working on alternatives. At the European level, you could have a pan-European initiative, for example, to promote growth. Institutions like the European Investment Bank, the structural funds could be mobilized, and with little public money, you could actually have, at a pan-European level, measures to encourage investment and growth and employment. With calculated, you could easily generate, with the existing institutions, at least 1 million or 2 million jobs in Europe, which is, wouldn't solve the problem, but it would move in the right direction. Secondly, Germany should slow down the crazy pace of fiscal consolidation that it is embarking on. It doesn't need to, having a big current account surplus, to have massive fiscal consolidation. And it could increase real wages. That would make Germans happier. They could have a better standard of living, and they would increase aggregate demand for the deficit countries. And similarly, the UK, there are a lot of studies that show that if there wasn't this self-imposed austerity that Mr. Osborne has provoked, you could have much better growth outcomes in the UK. So if you had Germany and the UK growing more, if you gave a bit more flexibility for the countries that are in deficit, I mean, if you allow them to have more gradual austerity, you could have an alternative Europe that would not have these crazy electoral results that could restart a process of growth, rather than this process of austerity that offers no hope to people and that hits particularly poorer people so badly, as does the sequester in the United States, as would sequester in the United States.
Again, I'm speaking with economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who is in London. She's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University, and she's the author of the book Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. So given that we have this extraordinary situation with Berlusconi doing so surprisingly well in this election, has created a kind of political stalemate in Europe's third largest economy. So it's not insignificant. And he ran so much against austerity, which is an irony. And then, of course, he also ran against Angela Merkel. What kind of bitterness is there between Merkel and Berlusconi? Surely there's some bad blood there.
Well, there is tension between the sort of so-called southern countries and the Germans, because they feel that Germany has been precisely imposing this pattern of austerity. There has been, of course, very strong protest votes previously in Greece, and the figures, I think, completely wrong, portraying Angela Merkel as neo-Nazi or something like that. But it's actually very paradoxical that this austerity and the crisis has actually increased divisions between, has sort of spurred nationalism and increased divisions within the European Union, when the whole idea of the European Union is never again the rise of nationalism. So I think the big fault of the German current government is that it has imposed this austerity. I mean, they have been quite generous in the rescue packages, but at the same time, they have done these rescues at the condition of continued austerity. Even the very good promise of intervention by Mario Draghi of offering to buy Italian and Spanish bonds if necessary, which has been up till today, very good in lowering spreads of those governments' bonds, was also linked to their continuation of these austerity programs. And therefore, the whole kind of policy response is based on this dramatic austerity, both in the crisis countries, but even in the surplus countries. And it's the collective imposition of austerity in all European countries at the same time, which is, logically reinforcing this very negative evolution of the economies. I mean, if you think that in Spain, over half of young people are unemployed, as is the case in Greece. I mean, it is a completely unsustainable policy. And one would hope that finally, in countries like in Germany or the UK, people would understand that these policies are both economically wrong and politically unsustainable.
Well, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, one would think that given the examples that you just gave, which are there for all to see, why is the Republicans in the House here in the United States about to set the U.S. on the path to austerity, given the calamitous evidence that's out there?
Well, I think it's completely irrational from an economic point of view. It's purely ideological. I think they just want to favor the richer segments of the society. And I think they have a basic misunderstanding of economics. And I don't understand how leading politicians of the largest economy in the world can take such completely irresponsible attitudes, unless they finally, at the last hour, hopefully, reach some kind of compromise. But I think this would also be a very unequal, not only would it be a very bad crisis in the sense that it would lead to possibly a recession in the United States, but of course a lot of the cost of this sequester would be hitting the poor, because a lot of these entitlement programs like Social Security would have to suffer. So in that sense, one can understand that ideologically the Republicans are trying to do this, but they're doing it in a way that is completely brutal and is completely self-destructive. I mean, I think that ideology is driving them to completely irrational outcomes, even from their own perspective, which is quite scary.
Well, one of the heroes who tried to stop the 2008 crash, or at least warned about it well in advance, Sheila Bair, has an op-ed in Wednesday's New York Times where she basically, and she makes it clear that she is a Republican.
Yes.
And says, you know, this is not my party. This is a party that only cares about the super rich. I mean, that's what's extraordinary, is the fealty to the billionaires that they all, the Republicans, particularly these Tea Party types who are supposed to be populists. That's what's so extraordinary, is how brazen they are. And the president still, I don't think, has managed to really draw the line there. He keeps referring to they only care about taking care of the wealthiest and don't care about the middle class. But now it's sort of disintegrated into a he said, she said kind of spat. And I think by and large, you know, an increasing majority of the American people are probably fed up with both parties.
Yes, but I think that the Republicans have this irresponsible attitude that they want the president to fail. They tried it last time, and they didn't succeed, and they didn't get elected. But they have both, irrational, I think, wish to have the Democrats fail, and unashamedly, as you say, and as Sheila Bair said, are just trying to favor the ultra-rich by massive tax cuts and so on. And they have no kind of, I would say, link with reality of the possible consequences of their action. So one would hope that in the end they will see some sense, but it's very scary that they should take things so much to the brink.
Well, the reality, though, is that we have a system, a political system, electoral system, I should say, a campaign system, based on money. So to that extent, what they're doing makes sense, because they're taking care of their billionaire patrons.
Exactly, because especially with the more recent changes in the law, this allows, as you know better than me, that the billionaires can dictate and can help create these crazy movements like the Tea Party, which has some popular support, but which are basically backed by money. I was just talking to a kind of friend of mine who's a very moderate Democrat, and she said, I'm embarrassed about my country because so many people repeat things, even on the media, that are completely false. And because they repeat it all the time, it sort of becomes a truth. So it's the control that they have of the electoral process and of the media, which has completely distorted the economic discussion. And the rational voices, like those of, again, to name two, Stiglitz and Krugman, are you know, so clear, but they're not listened to enough.
So what is the discussion going on now in London and in European capitals about the American economy, given its important role, and the idea that it has sort of gone from these manufactured crises from one to another. And the president has said that this is no way to govern a country from crisis to crisis, all of which are manufactured crises. And of course, we'll have another one in March and then the debt ceiling later in the year. And it just goes on and on. What's the attitude that you get from your colleagues and in the economics and the political world?
Well, in Europe, people are now this week focused much more, perhaps short-sightedly, but on Italy and the impact it will have on the European economy, because that is a major source of concern. I have been recently in Latin America, in Mexico, and what is interesting there, but also in the rest of the developing world, in Asia and in Africa, I mean, people just don't understand what's happened to the leadership of the developed countries. Because luckily, at least for now, the developing countries are still growing. The IMF has projected they will grow by 5.5%. And people just don't understand what is irrationality. And that is a further deep irrationality, that Europe is so focused on itself and the U.S. is in the middle of this irrational discussion. But these are countries that need economies, that need to compete in the global marketplace. They need to compete with countries like China and India, who are pursuing, on the whole, you know, they may have their problems, but they're pursuing rational policies. They don't have these crazy policies. It's a luxury that the United States and Europe cannot afford, not just for its own economy, but also for its competitive position. For example, having a dysfunctional financial system, like in many ways we still have in the United States and Europe, because the proper regulation is still not kicked into place, because there's always this pushback from vested interests. You know, it's completely inappropriate if we want to compete in this globalized economy. And on top of that, these crazy macroeconomic policies which are dragging down our economies, both in the U.S. and Europe, are posing a massive burden. I mean, you know, we're not thinking about investing. We're not thinking about expanding universities. When you go to these developing countries, it's so refreshing. People are opening new universities, opening new science parks, thinking what areas to invest in. And we've forgotten that because, as you say, we're going from one crisis to another.
Well, Stephanie Griffith-Jones, I thank you so much for joining us here today from London.
It's a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with economist Stephanie Griffith-Jones, who is in London. She's currently the Financial Markets Program Director at the Initiative for Policy Dialogue at Columbia University, and she's the author of the book Time for a Visible Hand, Lessons from the 2008 World Financial Crisis. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graeme Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.